From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since the very earliest days of this country, Americans and great American thinkers have argued over the proper role of government in the economy, when it should dive in, when it should move over. Hamiltonians have said, bring on the big government investment in canals, highways, universities, the internet. Jeffersonians say, bench the government, unleash individuals. It's a debate that's white hot on the campaign trail right now. This hour, On Point, Michael Lind on the great tug of war in American economic history on the role of government. You can join the conversation today. Are you having this argument with your friends, with yourself? Do we need government to dive in or clear out? Which engine do we need more right now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear a bit of another commencement speech, strikingly optimistic, from Fareed Zakaria. But first, joining me today from Washington is Michael Lind, political historian, co-founder of the New America Foundation, looking now at the great debate over government's role in the economy. His new book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Michael Lind, welcome. Great to have you back.
Thank you.
So you couldn't be right out of the headlines. Mitt Romney, after his Texas primary win yesterday, going right at President Obama in this issue, saying, we've got to unleash free enterprise, get government out of the way. How far back does this debate go in our national history, Michael?
Well, it goes all the way back to the founding, to the rivalry of Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, and Thomas Jefferson, the first Secretary of State. Americans have never been divided between capitalism and socialism. The debate has been over kinds of capitalism. And I argue in my book, Land of Promise, that the Hamiltonian vision is of developmental capitalism, in which government, business, and sometimes labor and research universities are partners in a common collaborative project of national development. The rival Jeffersonian vision, which I call the producerist vision, based on the small producer, views collaboration both among businesses and between business and government as a highly suspect evidence of corruption. Their vision, the Jeffersonian vision, is much more adversarial, wanting arm's length distance between government and business.
So help us, we'll go back and look at that history. Help us put current politics in that context, Michael. Here was, this was Mitt Romney after the Texas vote. He was in Las Vegas last night at a fundraiser sponsored by his former rival in the primaries, Donald Trump. And here he is saying the U.S. is at an economic crossroads, kind of big government versus free enterprise.
If we turn away from this path towards Europe, if we instead turn back to the principles that made us who we are, you're going to see a resurgence in the American economy that's going to surprise the world and put Americans to work in ways that will give us confidence in our future.
Mitt Romney on his Texas win last night in Las Vegas. Is that the Jeffersonian message, Michael?
Yes, Romney's rhetoric is very Jeffersonian. The parties have switched on this. For most of American history, the Democratic Party, based in the South and the West, and heavily agrarian, tended to be the Jeffersonian party. The Hamiltonians were concentrated among the merchants and industrialists of the Northeast and the Midwest. Since the 1960s and the Civil Rights Revolution, the base of the Republican Party has become the Deep South, the former Jeffersonian heartland. And if you look at the electoral map, Barack Obama got pretty much the same states that William McKinley got in 1896. And so even though the parties have switched, these two enduring traditions have been very similar for more than two centuries.
What were they arguing about two centuries ago in material terms about what ought to be done or not done by whom?
Well, there was a fundamental philosophical question after the American Revolution of whether the United States should be a new Britain, as Hamilton and his allies wanted, a much larger and more successful version.
That is, industrial powerhouse straddling the world in its markets? Or what did that mean?
Exactly. Or whether, as the Jeffersonians preferred, it would be an anti-Britain, a kind of a giant agrarian Switzerland, which would have an isolationist foreign policy and a population made up mostly of small farmers. Of course, nowadays, the agrarian aspect of Jeffersonianism is obsolete, with only a few people in agriculture, thanks to the productivity of American agriculture. But even though you no longer have the agrarian base for Jeffersonianism, a lot of its themes are very deeply rooted in American culture. For example, the term big is used as an insult. Big oil, big government, mm-hmm. big labor. To my amusement, recently the conservative opponents of the environmental movement have started talking about big green. So okay. So in that sense, we're a very Jeffersonian country in rhetoric, if not necessarily in reality.
So what was it that they were arguing over in terms of projects? Or, I mean, what was it that Hamilton wanted to do? And why did he think that government ought to do it instead of, you know, let loose private capital?
Well, remember, at the time, there was very little private capital, and most of it was foreign. Most of it was European. Hamilton and Washington and the early Congress inherited a country where 9 out of 10 people were farmers, where there was very little infrastructure. And so Hamilton argued both for a national bank, which would mobilize British and European capital to help develop the United States, for a system of a national infrastructure, and also for a temporary protectionist tariffs to protect infant American industries until they were strong enough to compete with the industries of Britain, which was the first industrial power, and it was the major economy in the world all the way well into the 19th century. So the Hamiltonian program was essentially one of catching up with and surpassing industrial Britain. The Jeffersonians rejected this in favor of the idea of the United States as a kind of opposite of Western Europe and Britain. It would forswear great power politics. It wouldn't have a big standing army. And it would have a very decentralized economy based on small farmers, small businessmen, and small bankers.
Now, that dichotomy seems to me very long gone. If you find Hamiltonians and Jeffersonians today, I mean, big business wants to be big, wants to be global. Nobody really argues against the sort of Great Britain model of old anymore in this country, except if you get all the way out to what your Republicans call big green, you've got sort of a locavore environmentalist who say, let's get real Jeffersonian and small farmy.
Well, at the same time, we do have all sorts of policies that promote Jeffersonian ends. For example, a single-family home ownership, which is kind of the modern version of the family farm. There are a great number of regulatory rules that discriminate in favor of small businesses against big businesses. And our rhetoric about even high technology is sort of distorted, in my view, by romanticizing small enterprises. You know, there's this obsession with startups and IPOs, when in reality, a few of the successful startups grow into giant leviathans like Google and Microsoft, just as the successful enterprises of the past have done. So there is something of a disconnect between the reality of a national and global economy with colossal enterprises and a permanently big government, and our rather nostalgic Jeffersonian rhetoric longing for the good old days of small producers.
Take us across that time horizon of history here. Who were the big, let's say, Hamiltonians first and the big projects that they pursued in this government needs to lead and do way?
Well, in my book, Land of Promise, I argue that there have been several waves of economic growth associated with particular transformative technologies, the first of which was the steam engine in the first half of the 19th century, then the automobile and the airplane and electricity in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and finally, the information technology revolution. The first wave of Hamiltonianism after Hamilton was carried on by Henry Clay, who ironically was a Southern slave owner, but he championed the interests of manufacturers in the North with what he called an American system based on centralized banking, national infrastructure program, and protection for American manufacturing. He failed during most of his career, but his program was enacted more or less intact under President Abraham Lincoln.
But what did it have to do with steam engine before we get to Lincoln? Steam engine comes along. So is that a Jeffersonian accomplishment or a Hamiltonian or a combo?
Well, the original Hamiltonian vision was based on the pre-steam era technology, which was canals and water mills. Mm-hmm. But by the 1830s, the locomotive, a steam engine on wheels, and steam-powered factories were beginning to transform the landscape.
Who gets credit for that in this sort of battle of worldviews? I mean, we associate it with Fulton and all the rest, with individuals, private enterprise.
Well, that's right. And initially, the development of steam textile factories, for example, was done by local capitalists. Mm-hmm. And that was also true of local railroads. But what you find with infrastructure technologies is that even if they start locally, in order to have a truly effective national system, down the road, the federal government needs to come in and sort of put in the capstone that connects all of the links. And that's what the Lincoln administration and Congress did with the Transcontinental Railroads, based on massive government land grants during the Civil War and afterwards.
And that was
and
just
it's
the start
what President
of his,
Eisenhower mm-hmm. did with the interstate highway system, mm-hmm. connecting what had been somewhat isolated regional and local systems of roadways.
You've got Abe Lincoln as a big Hamiltonian. He was freed from the South in those votes against that way by the Civil War, and went on to do not just the Transcontinental Railroad but investment, but state land-grant universities and more.
That's right. And what you see, I argue, in Land of Promise is that after 20 or 30 years of Hamiltonian centralized nation building, we tend to get a backlash, a Jeffersonian backlash, and that took place on schedule in the 1880s and 1890s. And it was associated not only with agrarian populists like William Jennings Bryan, but also with urban progressives like Louis Brandeis and to some degree Woodrow Wilson. I argue that beginning in the 60s and 70s, there's been a similar backlash. As you note, there are champions of decentralization and localism on the left as well as the right. And in rhetoric, anyway, that has been the dominant theme of and the dominant consensus, really going back to Jimmy Carter. We tend to think of this conservative Jeffersonian era as beginning with Ronald Reagan. But Carter was the first one to run as an outsider, nostalgic for a more rural America.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great American debate over the role of government in the economy. Hamilton versus Jefferson, government investment in canals, roads, bridges, technology, the future versus stand aside, Uncle Sam. Michael Lind is with us. His new book is Land of Promise, an economic history of the United States. And he reminds us this is a debate that has gone on for a long time. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. If you're into the great man theory of history, there was one who kind of brought that Jefferson era back in American politics, Ronald Reagan. Here he is in the dark days of recession after Jimmy Carter, as Michael Lind points out, but taking over from Carter, saying to help the country get back on its feet, his government would be the ungovernment.
We, as Americans, have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Ronald Reagan, 1981. 1996, President Bill Clinton took over, was there with a version of that, a kind of Democratic version of it. Here he is with his State of the Union address and one of his most famous lines you'll see here. But you'll notice it came with a big but.
The era of big government is over. But we cannot go back to the time when our citizens were left to fend for themselves. Instead, we must go forward as one America, one nation, working together to meet the challenges we face together. Self-reliance and teamwork are not opposing virtues. We must have both.
Self-reliance and teamwork. We must have both, said President Clinton. And here is Mitt Romney. This is, again, just yesterday, talking with supporters in the small coal town of Craig, Colorado, criticizing the sitting president, Barack Obama, for what he called a hostile attitude toward business.
Government sees small business and big business as the enemy. We're not the enemy. Some of these liberals say they like a strong economy, but then they act like they don't like business. An economy is nothing but the collection of all of our businesses together. I want our government to support small business, middle-sized business, big business. I want jobs. I want government that's an ally of business, not an enemy of business.
Michael Lind is with us. Mitt Romney's on it yesterday. Michael will take us on in. Lots of callers. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. What do you think, Jerry?
Well, I think we need some government, but I would have to agree with Governor Romney that too much government, it just stifles the businesses, Tom. And when your guest there was talking about the Transcontinental Railroads, Union Pacific's Vice President, Thomas Durant, he was upset with his workers for putting too much masonry in the culverts. They had to go back and rebuild all that stuff. It cost the taxpayers I mean, I think it was like $20 or $30 million. And when they went bankrupt, five of the transcontinentals, when they went into bankruptcy, J.P. Morgan bought them and then reorganized them where they made money and they didn't have to use government money anymore.
Jerry, you know the railroad history better than me. We'll take it to Michael Lynn, but you say, watch out. Don't stifle business and let us hold that one right there. We'll take it to Michael. One more first, if I may. Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Joe is calling. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that Jeffersonian philosophies may have been good back in Jeffersonian times. We're now living in Al Caponian times, where bootleggers and outlaws have put down guns and have picked up MBAs and law degrees. So, and they're a lot more dangerous now.
So do you want government regulation? Do you want government investment? Do you want the equivalent of, you know, building the interstate highway again, or just more oversight, Joe?
Well, we need more oversight. It seems as though, you know, these factions have gotten into government and relaxed the rules. Antitrust regulations are powerless whenever monopolies are defined as too big to fail. And I think that RICO laws should be enacted for people like Bernie Madoff so that they know that if they do these kind of shenanigans that rip people off and wreck pensions and city coffers, that they're going to forfeit everything.
So there's the other side of the coin. And, Joe, I appreciate your call as well. Michael Lind, there it is, right out of the gate. Government stifles business, says our caller Jerry. And Joe comes in and says it's not Jeffersonian times, Al Caponian times. What do you think, Michael?
Well, as your first caller suggested, there is a consensus, even among libertarians and conservatives, on the role of the federal government, also state and local governments, in providing infrastructure. I think what is often lost, and this isn't taught in Econ 101, but it's very important, is the distinction between different sectors of the economy. There's some industries where there are increasing returns to scale or network effects. And those tend to network effects, for example, in railroads and in telecommunications, increasing returns to scale in a lot of manufacturing. That's why you don't have a lot of mom-and-pop aircraft industries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why a continental electrical grid can be more stable than a countywide electrical grid. And from the late 19th century all the way to the present, politicians and economists and regulators have struggled with what to do with these particular increasing returns to scale and network effects sectors, because they're contrary to Econ 101. You tend to get natural monopolies and natural oligopolies.
But we don't have government-run aircraft manufacturers, though we've got a huge government market for them in the U.S. military. But you don't have mom-and-pop, but neither is it government.
Well, that's right. For example, on a global scale even, there are only two major aircraft manufacturers, Boeing and Airbus.
Mm.
The latter is essentially supported by the European government. So that modern societies, in dealing with these industries where you have these naturally colossal organizations, and if you look at search engines, for example, Google is an example,
mm-hmm.
Simply because of the increasing returns to scale and the network effects, you had one slightly superior version simply became the dominant firm in its particular field. And that's always been a challenge for public policy. Do you nationalize them? Do you socialize them? That's what many other industrial countries have done. In the United States, we have rejected that in favor of some kind of regulation, including utility regulation of electrical companies and, for example, water and sewage companies. So I think that that distinction needs to be made. In terms of the transcontinental railroads, I document the corruption incident with their corruption, with their construction during and after the Civil War in great detail in my book, Land of Promise.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to keep that in perspective. Private capital would not have built those transcontinental railroads. The one case of the Great Northern Railroad, which is often cited as an example of a private railroad, in fact received millions of acres of land grants that came attached to a previous railroad that it bought. And if you look at the enormous drop in freight costs as a result of having an integrated national system, then they paid for themselves many times over, even notwithstanding the gross corruption that took place.
I think most Americans, Michael Lind, look out on American history and the economy, and I think they kind of naturally imagine that we need both of these sources of dynamism, both of these engines, that, yeah, you build the interstate and then a lot of private commerce gets done on those. Are you arguing with that? I mean, you heard Bill Clinton there in his speech saying, era of big government is over, but we need both. Is both not the sort of natural American balance here?
Well, in Land of Promise, I do come down on the side of the Hamiltonian tradition, which I characterize as pro-business, pro-government, pro-labor, and pro-university. And the universities should not be left out in this. Research universities working with government, particularly the Pentagon, and the private sector, private corporations, have been responsible for most of the fundamental technological breakthroughs of the information technology revolution in which we're living today. In addition to nuclear energy, satellite technologies, space travel, many other things. So that I think public-private partnership needs to be redefined as public-private nonprofit partnership. And again, this is only in particular areas. There are whole aspects of American life where the Jeffersonian vision of lots of small firms competing in a competitive market makes perfect sense and should be cultivated. So, for example, if you look at restaurants, there are no increasing returns to scale really in restaurants. And so a mom-and-pop restaurant is not necessarily less efficient than a franchise of a national chain. And so you can have both. You can have a concentrated industrial sector dominated by large firms, often working with government and with universities on technological breakthroughs. And at the same time, you can have much of the population employed in fairly small-scale enterprises or in some cases, enterprises they own themselves.
So where are we today, then? If you look at it broad stroke at the country, you know, the balance we have today versus, let's say, your vision, and we'll look more at what that is, but your vision of the optimum.
Well, we've shifted far too much in the direction of the Jeffersonian backlash, in my view, since the 1970s and the 1980s. And the Democrats under Clinton have – and you see a similar phenomenon in Europe where the new Labor Party of Tony Blair essentially internalized Reagan-Thatcher ideology about the evils of government and the supremacy of markets instead of the need to collaborate among between these different sectors. So I think we need to change our rhetoric. Now, in practice – as I point out, Jeffersonian presidents, including Thomas Jefferson himself, have been much more moderate when they came to power than they were when they were out of power. Just as Ronald Reagan ended up imposing tariffs to protect certain American industries and left Social Security and Medicare alone, you know, I don't doubt that if Romney became president, he would govern in a much more moderate manner than his anti-government rhetoric suggests.
What's the evidence?
I do think the rhetoric is damaging. The rhetoric's damaging.
What's the evidence that we're materially out of balance now by your lights, Michael?
Well, infrastructure spending as a percentage of GDP is far below what it was during the so-called golden age of American capitalism after 1945, from World War II until the 60s. If you look at cutting-edge areas of technology, such as exascale computing, this is supercomputing, which has the potential to revolutionize business and daily life as much as the Internet has. The United States is losing out in some of this to government-funded efforts in East Asia and Western Europe, so that particularly in the realms of R&D and infrastructure, we need more government. Now, that's not at the expense of the private sector because the private sector simply does not invest in long-term R&D unless it can reap the profits, and it doesn't invest in infrastructure, which is a public good. So this kind of public investment complements rather than competes with the private sector.
David Brooks writes in the New York Times in the last few days that, yes, there's a role for that kind of big government investment, but the big government we have today, he says, is pouring it into social programs, not into the more almost mercenary investments in nationalist economic growth that previous Hamiltonians favored. You know, that it's so when government spends today, Brooks suggests, we don't get the same payoff.
Well, it's a false comparison. It's a false trade-off. He's trying to pose a trade-off between social insurance programs like Social Security and Medicare and public investment, for example, in highways and enlarging ports and in new natural gas pipelines and or high-speed rail, as the case may be. These have completely different financing mechanisms. long-term investments in infrastructure ought to be paid for by borrowing. You know, that's the whole idea behind a national infrastructure bank. All state, local, and city governments pay for their capital improvement projects by means of municipal bonds. They don't pay for it out of current taxation, although they may use taxes as well as user fees to repay the bondholders over time. The federal government lacks that capability. If it was able to leverage the vast amounts of private capital out there looking for safe and decent returns by investing in infrastructure, then it could tap into an entire revenue stream and it wouldn't have to try to go after Social Security or Medicare revenues.
But he's, you know, his line is, a government that was energetic and limited was turned into one that is omnidirectional and fiscally unsustainable, and looks over his shoulder at Europe.
Well, Europe, actually, if you look at the northern European countries, they consistently beat us in international levels of competitiveness or are tied with us, like Scandinavia, like Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, where about half of GDP goes to government. So clearly, very large proportion of GDP going to government is not correlated with poor economic performance. On the contrary, if you look at the broken down third world and some people say fourth world countries, that have the poorest economies in the world, they tend to have much smaller government shares of the economy than we do. So this is fundamentally a myth by people who don't know the economic data. The truth is that as technological societies become more advanced, they have bigger government because they can afford it. And to the extent that government is public investment in public goods, including education of a skilled workforce, then it pays for itself through higher economic growth in time.
As long as you keep the right balance there, Europe now struggling with not being able to afford. Peter in Andover, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air with Michael Lind.
Well, yes, this is a very interesting dichotomy that we're examining. You know, on one hand, we see the Obama camp who promotes this whole notion of prospering the government teeth, if you will. Prime example being the so-called Julia piece that it put up on the internet versus a guy like Mitt Romney who pretty much promotes the whole notion of bootstrapping, you know, getting up and making something of oneself on his own or her own. And I think that's a very important distinction to be drawn here between the role of government as someone who supports a person to succeed or fail versus supporting that person just to succeed.
Peter, our time is short before the break, but Michael Lind, you hear this again and again. Americans look and say, you know, we don't want dependence. May want government investment, but not in a dependent way. Get out there and bootstrap. Get out there and let individuals go.
Well, I think there is a fundamental consensus on that. If you look at most of the partisan debates about government, it tends to be social welfare programs, whether they are universal programs like Social Security and Medicare or means-tested programs like Medicaid and food stamps, where the concern has always been that the social safety net will turn into a hammock, as some people have said, and diminish the work incentive. That's a debate worth having. But that's really not central to the fundamental question of what will drive growth. Will the economy flourish better if you have business and government working together, or should you minimize government as much as possible and then have an unregulated private sector? And I suggest in my book, Land of Promise, that the Hamiltonian vision of a kind of developmental capitalism in which government, business, or partners has been the most successful formula for nearly two centuries.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great American debate over the role of government in the economy. Hamilton versus Jefferson. Government investment in canals, roads, bridges, technology, the future versus stand aside, Uncle Sam. You can hear it in the presidential campaign right now very vividly. Michael Lind is writing about the history in his new book, Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. Well, here in a few minutes, the Harvard commencement address from last week by Fareed Zakaria, quite an optimistic note we'll hear from that address. Michael, lots of response online. John writes, says, free enterprise is a great concept, should be allowed to get things like cell phones, iPads, Twitter. However, he writes, living in rural Vermont, if government hadn't stepped in, we wouldn't have electricity, mail delivery, phone service, internet connectivity, etc. So we need a combination of free enterprise and government involvement. Greg writes to us online here, isn't this a false dilemma, Michael? It says both models are possible in the same country so long as government is willing to allow small businesses to act independently. What do you say, Michael, then?
Well, I think that's right. There's kind of an asymmetry between the Hamiltonian tradition and the Jeffersonian tradition when it comes to the question of a small and big business. The Jeffersonians, many of them have actually believed that all big business by itself is bad. It's inefficient. It would exist only because of corruption of the government by greedy private capitalists. That seems to have been the belief of Louis Brandeis, very influential Jeffersonian progressive, who wrote about the curse of bigness.
But that was lost somewhere along the way because Mitt Romney has nothing against bigness, if it's profitable, as far as I know.
Well, that's right. But you do see this, for example, in the debate about break up the banks. Do you use antitrust policy to break up large enterprises, or do you use regulatory policy to allow them to exist as monopolies or oligopolies, but then to regulate their behavior? But what I want to say is that the Hamiltonians have always had plenty of room within Hamiltonianism, within their vision of the American economy, for a sector of small businesses and small farms. And indeed, when the Hamiltonians have been politically successful, they've made alliances in politics with Jeffersonians. So, for example, one of the reasons Abraham Lincoln and his allies, who had been members of the Whig Party, the Hamiltonian party of Henry Clay, were able to succeed in making the Republican Party a majority party was they won over many Jeffersonian and Jacksonian farmers with the Homestead Act, giving settlers free land out of the federal lands if they worked on it. You see the same thing in the New Deal, where the Hamiltonian elements coexisted with a lot of support for traditionally Jeffersonian goals like federal deposit insurance, which benefits small banks, and rural electrification.
Homesteaders, my family included. Kim in Rock Island, Illinois, you're on the air with Michael Lind. Thanks for calling, Kim.
Well, and a happy Wednesday. Thanks, Tom. I think we all can agree that greed and self-centeredness is what has brought us to this point as far as breaking our governments, our unions, our capitalistic views. But to me, it just seems as though it's actually large corporations, your petroleum, your pharmaceutical, your insurance companies, that are actually what are stopping small businesses from really being able to enter the free market. We have to go through them to get anything. They're the ones that make all the laws, all the rules. To me, this isn't rocket science. It seems that it would be very easy to actually start manufacturing and you know, make it so that everybody has a say in it, whether, you know, really utilize, like, methane. Go back to old school things with a futuristic flair. Back before the 1920s, they grew production hemp, which everybody gets weirded about because they say it's marijuana, and it's not. And you can get paper, oil, fabrics, ethanol. It's a rotation crop.
Hey, Kim, I think we've got the gist of it, and let me pick it up there if I may, and I appreciate your call. I like your old school with a futuristic flair. Michael Lind, what about it? Big business so dominant economically and politically that the pump isn't working somehow is, I guess, Kim's
point.
Well,
I think you have to distinguish barriers to a market entry by small firms that are the result of the corruption of the political process by big business. And you actually, you know, find some regulations that are written to protect big businesses from small businesses. But the more important barrier is simply the barriers I've already mentioned, increasing returns to scale in manufacturing and network effects in things like communications and transportation grids. It may very well be that futuristic technology may eliminate at least some of the barriers formed by increasing returns to scale. So, for example, we're seeing the rapid development of something called rapid prototyping or 3D printing,
mm-hmm.
which allows small runs, small production runs, or in some cases, single custom-made products
mm-hmm.
to be made by factories much smaller than the traditional factories of the 19th and 20th centuries. So, you know, I'm open-minded. It's just purely a technological question whether you can shrink the scale. And if that's the case, you may indeed see a renaissance of small production. But it does depend on the technology. It's not simply a matter of political will or of legislation.
Fred in York, Maine. Thanks for calling, Fred. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I pretty much lived all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me that the South and the West, the Jeffersonian stronghold of today, has received probably more benefit from government programs than the rest of the country. And I can mention like the TVA, the Grand Coulee Dam, the mm-hmm. Hoover Dam, rural electrification, Dust Bowl relief. Most of the military bases today are in the South or the West.
Yep.
And even the space program was pretty much centered down south.
So there's a geography, a kind of contradiction in the geography you're thinking here,
yeah,
Fred.
That's what I'm saying.
Michael, well, that's
a very perceptive observation, and it's also a generational thing within regions. So, for example, in the 19th century, when the Northeast and the Midwest were still developing regions, they wanted federal government-backed infrastructure, and then once the infrastructure was built, in the early 1900s, suddenly they discovered that laissez-faire should rule and government was bad and the free market was the way. You've seen a similar kind of a generational cycle in the South and the West. In the middle of the 20th century, you had a congressman like the young Lyndon Johnson allied with the federal government to put factories and military bases all through the South and the West and to build up an infrastructure. Once the South caught up, at least in terms of modern conveniences with the North, largely because of federal investment. You know, then you got a new generation of Southern and Western politicians who decided that government wasn't all that great after all when they no longer needed it.
Yeah. Greg in East Lansing, Michigan. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Mm-hmm. I have a question about how this debate matches up with Tea Party Republicans
mm-hmm.
who are evidently so concerned about budget deficits they might be termed as no growth mix. And whether they could be placed in the either Jeffersonian camp or in the Hamiltonian camp.
Interesting, especially when it comes around that deficit focus. Michael?
Oh, the Tea Party is definitely a Jeffersonian movement. The Jeffersonians traditionally have had a deep dread of debt, which Alexander Hamilton defended as long as it was moderate and could be paid down as an essential element of growth. You know, businesses grow by taking on debt in many cases, which they then pay down out of revenues as they get bigger, and countries do the same thing. Jeffersonians have never really understood this.
What about when it's not moderate, though?
Well, of course, you don't want immoderate debt, which can only be gotten rid of by either default or by inflation.
Isn't that where we are, immoderate debt?
No, not at all. The United States, if you look at the debt as a share of GDP, is about in the middle of the industrial countries, meaning about half of industrial countries are worse off. And depending on whether you use the borrowing to invest in things that promote future growth, for example, using stimulus money to invest in productive infrastructure, the more you grow, the sooner you pay off the debt. So you can't look at it in abstract
mm-hmm.
Terms. You have to look at it both in the historic context and also in the uses to which the borrowing is put. Now, if you borrow money to pay for wars or to fund tax cuts for the rich, that is an unproductive use.
One more call,
borrowing.
If I may. Akshat in Bloomington, Indiana. Akshat, you're on the air with Michael Lind.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask about where political centrists fall on this issue. I think Michael Lind identifies as a political centrist, and he co-wrote a book about it about 10 years ago. So I'm wondering what kind of capitalism, as he said, he thinks political centrists should be advocating. And also, are centrists making those kind of arguments? Because it seems to me that most self-identifying centrists today usually advocate a mushy middle between whatever the two parties are saying at any given moment.
Akshat,
you're a coherent philosophy.
Yeah, we got it. Our time is so short, but Michael Lind, we've got a couple of minutes here. What do you say?
Well, unfortunately, I don't use the word centrist anymore because the term centrism has been co-opted by conservatives who are really fiscal conservatives. And their obsession is with the debt and small government. They're not bothered by enormous tax cuts for the rich. You see this, for example, in the so-called centrist support for the Bowles-Simpson plan, which actually is a very regressive conservative plan to slash benefits for the middle class to fund tax cuts for the rich. So I think the term center is best dropped. And it's better not to think about these in terms of left, right, and center, as I say, but as I suggest in Land of Promise, as Hamiltonian or Jeffersonian.
But you kind of suggest that there isn't a great compromise here. You say it'd be nice to conclude that some, you know, that the dynamic between these two leads us to some optimal, I don't know, mean. But you say that wouldn't be true.
Well, in the long run, the Hamiltonian vision of developmental capitalism by mastering new waves of technology and unleashing new waves of productivity growth allows Jeffersonians to flourish, but it is within this larger context created by, at the end of the day, big government, big industry, and also, frankly, big science.
So do you come down to the left or right of Barack Obama or right with the sitting president?
I think Obama has been good in his emphasis on public investment. I think in his some of his statements about the deficit have been premature and contractionary. You actually don't want to cut government spending at a time when consumer spending has collapsed, because that tends to contract demand further and keep you mired in a depression over time.
Michael Lind is co-founder of the New America Foundation in Washington. His new book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Lind, it's been great talking with you today. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks.
In a moment, journalist Fareed Zakaria's address to Harvard's class of 2012. This is On Point. This commencement season, we've brought you speeches from around the country, Liberty University, Barnard, the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Last week, journalist Fareed Zakaria, CNN host and editor-at-large at Time magazine, addressed new graduates at Harvard. He spoke with optimism about the world they're entering, despite tough economic times, the age of terror, and concerns about the planet. Here's a bit of that commencement address.
I want to sketch out for you, perhaps with a little bit of historical perspective, the world as I see it. The world we live in is, first of all, at peace, profoundly so. The richest countries of the world are not in major geopolitical, geomilitary competition with one another. No arms races, no proxy races, no wars, no cold wars among the richest countries of the world. You would have to go back hundreds of years to find an equivalent period of political stability. I know that you see a bomb going off in Afghanistan or hear of a terror plot in New York and worry about the safety and security of our times. But here is the data. The number of people who have died as a result of war, civil war, and yes, terrorism, is down 50% this decade from the 1990s. It is down 75% from the preceding five decades. It is down, of course, 99% from the decade before that, which was World War II. Steven Pinker argues that we are living in the most peaceful times in human history, and he should know because he is a Harvard professor. The political stability that we have experienced has allowed the creation of a single global economy that has allowed countries from all over the world to participate and flourish. In 1980, the number of countries that were growing at 4% a year, robust growth, was about 60. By 2007, that number had doubled. And even after the financial crisis, that number stands today at about 80. So countries around the world are thriving and flourishing in a way that was previously unimaginable. Even if in the current decade, with all this slow growth, the global economy as a whole will grow 10 to 20% faster than it did last decade, 60% faster than it did two decades ago, and five times as fast as it did three decades ago. The result is that the United Nations estimates in the last 50 years, poverty has been reduced more than in the preceding 500 years. Most of that reduction has taken place in the last 20. The average Chinese person is today 10 times richer than he or she was 50 years ago, with 25 years more of life expectancy. Life expectancy has risen across the world dramatically. We gain 5 hours of life expectancy every day. Imagine that, without even exercising. A third of all the babies born in the developed world this year will live to be 100. All this is, of course, because of rising standards of living, of hygiene and medicine. Atul Gawande, another Harvard professor, who is also a practicing surgeon, who also writes for the New Yorker magazine, tells of a 19th century operation, perhaps not so uncommon, in which a surgeon was trying to amputate a patient's leg. He succeeded. He also, however, amputated his assistant's hand. The two patients, I suppose one would call them, died of sepsis. An onlooker died of shock. It is the only known medical procedure to have a 300% fatality. We've come a long way. To understand the astonishing age of progress, just look at the cell phones you have in your pockets. And yes, I know many of you don't have them in your pockets. They're already out. You're looking at them right now. That cell phone has more computing power than the Apollo space capsule that went to the moon. That capsule couldn't even tweet. So imagine the opportunities that lie ahead.
Fareed Zakaria speaking at Harvard University's commencement last Thursday. For a full transcript and video of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. It's nice to hear an optimistic message there. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.